Hello and welcome to the AHRQ webinar on building and maintaining a sustainable health information exchange. At this point, I'd like to introduce today's moderator, Erin Grace. Ms. Grace is AHRQ's Senior Manager for Health Information Technology and Senior Advisor for Rural and Community Health. In this role, she manages grants, contracts, and other initiatives related to health IT, including AHRQ-funded state and regional demonstration projects in health IT and the contract to provide technical assistance related to health IT and health information exchange for Medicaid and state children's health insurance program agencies. Erin, welcome, and the floor is all yours.
Thank you, Colin, and I'd like to welcome everybody this afternoon and especially our esteemed list of presenters that we will be having today. Our first presenter, and I'll just introduce them all at one time, and then we'll go through their slides. Our first presenter today is Dr. Mark Frissy, who is a professor of biomedical informatics at Vanderbilt University. He created and directed a federal and state-sponsored health information exchange in the greater Memphis area with over 5 million records covering the care of 1.2 million individuals. He is also the co-chair of the Markle Foundation's Connecting for Health Common Framework Policy Group, developing model data sharing agreements, as well as a member of the American Medical Association's Health Information Policy Committee. Dr. Frissy has also served as a professor of medicine and associate dean at the Washington University School of Medicine, vice president and chief medical officer at Express Scripts, and played a role in developing consumer websites, the drugdigest.org consumer resource, and RX Hub. Our second presenter today will be Patricia Fontaine, Dr. Patricia Fontaine, who is an associate professor of family medicine and community health at the University of Minnesota Medical School. She divides her time between teaching and clinical research and currently serves as president of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. She has extensive experience in practice-based research through the Minnesota Academy of Family Physician Research Network. Her funded work for the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality has focused on topics of national importance for primary care, including health information exchange, medical office safety, and the patient-centered medical home. And our third presenter today will be Gina Perez, who is president of Advances in Management, Inc., which is a management consulting firm. Since 2004, Advances in Management has been engaged by the Delaware Health Information Network to provide project direction for the Health Information Exchange, which is a statewide effort to create an interoperable healthcare system in Delaware. In this role, Ms. Perez provides strategic direction and day-to-day executive management for the DIN, reporting to the Board of Directors. In the spring of 2000, DIN went live and became the first statewide health information exchange in the nation. Ms. Perez serves as the Department of Health and Human Services, on the Department of Health and Human Services Standards Committee, on the Certification Commission for Health Information Technology, HIE Certification Work Group, and the state-level HIE Steering Committee, as well as the statewide HIE Coalition. So as you can see, we have some very strong presenters today, and I think we will be learning a lot from them. So without further ado, I'll remind you to please feel free to submit your questions during the presentations. We'll do the actual question and answer period after the presentations, and I'll turn it over to Dr. Frissy.
Thank you, Erin. I am been asked to talk about the role Vanderbilt played in creating a health information exchange organization in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm coming to the end of Vanderbilt's role in this. I'm thrilled to say that the Memphis community, a very vibrant, active group, has taken over this largely over the last few years, and by the end of September, the Vanderbilt relationship with that will have terminated, our contract will have terminated, and the story you'll be hearing in the future will be coming almost entirely by the Mid-South eHealth Alliance Board and the people in Memphis, Tennessee, and the next chapter should be wonderful. The other reason this is a timely conference, I think, is because many of you may have attended an ONC-funded state health meeting in Arlington, Virginia this week. I was not there, but some of the other of us have attended a follow-on conference with the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality and other agencies, including ONC. And one of the big issues that came up is just, what does exchange really mean? How has it changed, and what does it mean in this era of high tech and the various disparate federal initiatives as well as private sector initiatives going on? So I need to take you back to 2004. This is before ONC. If you remember, the ARC-SRD contracts were announced by ARC as five-year initiatives, again, before ONC was formed. The primary goal of those contracts was to basically understand how healthcare would change if we put the patient in the middle. And from the outset, we at Vanderbilt, who had been charged by the governor and were the PIs reporting to the state of Tennessee to create this, viewed exchange organizations somewhat as a means to an end of patient-centered care, more information at the point of decision, be you a consumer and the public, to achieve better health care outcomes. That was the spirit of the ARC five-year contract, and I think what you'll hear from at least two of us who were involved in that today. As is the case with many, we had reasons to do this that anticipated the ARC contracts. Governor Phil Bredesen was facing, a newly appointed governor, a major crisis in health care financing in the state of Tennessee, which is not a surprise to any of you from state government. We had a large county hospital called the Regional Medical Center, or the MED, that was in grave distress, and Governor Bredesen, in his February 2004 speech to the legislature, talked about a technology informatics adjunct approach to supporting this with through a collaboration of Vanderbilt and the MED. What we found out almost immediately, of course, was that when you look at an ailing hospital, you're really not looking at a single organization. You're looking at a community in distress, and I would submit all of us, every community, is more or less in some degree of distress. So we really wanted to look at how this could be done. Now, the exciting thing about Memphis, quite frankly, was that the payer mix would be considered fairly negative in terms of a high number of uninsured, high number of 10 care, but I actually was attracted to that because that gave a person a chance to do some very dramatic, innovative things along the spirit of what Clayton Christensen from Harvard Business School would talk about. There weren't very many competitors out there, not many rivals. We ultimately received, after a planning grant that was funded privately, a $5 million ARC contract as well as some money from the state legislature. And more than anything else, we had a leadership team starting with the governor, the mayor of the city, county in Memphis, the board in Memphis, and the commissioner of finance, Dave Getz, and others to be consistently supportive of all this. And I'll return to that in a minute. The next thing to look at is, what did we really do? Well, as Aaron said, we have over 5 million encounter records, and we have information, clinical information, of over 1.2 million people. This is not just claims. This is not just emergency room visits. This is not just one or two hospitals. This is literally everyone who did not opt out in all the major hospitals in Memphis, Tennessee, and quite a few of the larger county and safety net clinics. That was the scope of what we tried to do. We have large numbers there, as you will see, and we have been in operation in another week, total full operation for 4 years now, and so we have a lot of data to start being able to demonstrate what the impact of this hospital-based change has been. As you can see from the next list, and all these things are out on the web multiple places, and no doubt will be posted from this. This was a hospital-focused organization. The initial premise was, our hospitals were in distress. You have to go where there's a significant critical mass of intellectual capital and financial capital and get their buy-in first. And again, in 2004, that seemed to be the right strategy, and I think it's still the right strategy in many urban communities today. Our primary focus of work was on the emergency department in terms of use of that. That has been, I think, to be seen overall to be useful, because the hospitals basically felt if you could not demonstrate some impact in emergency department care, transitions in care, and test utilization, then they weren't quite sure how much of a difference it really made to the care of their community. So we had a very large group. You can see a website on the other side, and if you look a little closely, you'll see an RSA token. We did use two-factor authentication because the last thing we wanted in the world was to have any breaches or any privacy violations, and so we worked very hard to avoid that. What does the interface look like? Well, it's basically a much more stripped-down version of the Vanderbilt interface. I could show you slide after slide after slide. Most of the use, about 94% of the uses, were for basically looking at discharge summaries or individual laboratory tests. But what you see on this slide at the bottom, you see rows and columns of data, some red, some green. And if you look at that greenish-blue column, you'll see that there's all kinds of different abbreviations there. These are data from multiple different hospitals. Most of our patients had been to multiple different hospitals, and this is a demo data set, a composite, if you will, of numerous real instances. And what we were able to do was take the data in whatever format you have, Loink encode common data on the outbound, and then produce things like that graph, which is a pop-up window above, so you could look at the trend of, in this case, of a hematocrit over time from multiple hospitals, as if it came from one place, hospitals and clinics, I should add. The architecture was rather unusual. It remains viable today. It's led to a spin-off company, and it's being used throughout the state and the country at various organizations. It's basically a variant of what we've been doing at Vanderbilt Medical Center for 15 years. And I think it's important to emphasize what we did. We did not try to map every data item to some common standard on the inbound. We did not tell any of our participants what they had to send us, what format it had to be in, or anything else. Our criteria were very simple. One, you must have accurate ADT information so we knew who the patient was. Two, you must be able to tell us what the format of the data is, and we'll parse it from there. And the Vanderbilt approach throughout our organization and throughout our exchange efforts has been to take the data in whatever format it comes in, tag it, so say I'm a white count, or I'm a chest x-ray, or I'm a discharge summary, put that tag on it, throw it in the database, and every organization, you'll see the vault, every organization had its own logical database. So they could basically flush out that database at any time. It was almost like remote storage to them, except we had not translated the data at all, but we had put an extra tag on it so we could pull data across from disparate sources. Then we had basically a record located service, if you will, that we built a variant of what we had. We did not use a real expensive MPI system or anything to and prove that we could accurately merge these records, and then we just present them through a secure web browser. We only kept data integrated. The integrated patient database really is nothing more than an audit log of what took place. We don't keep any large centralized data, nor did we use it for anything other than patient care. There was no secondary data use at all. And a lesson I want to return to, of course, is that focus and staying focused on one or two things is absolutely critical. So why did we succeed? Now, one of the things I'm rather tickled about is apparently there was a wonderful set of discussions at the ONC meeting about leadership, and they used John Cotter's Why Transformation Efforts Fail framework. That's a common framework that a lot of people use. You will find that as a, basically the foundation for how we looked at this project in our 2004 application, which is out on the web. And we had this. We had a sense of urgency. We had a guiding coalition. We had some initial quick wins. We had some very, very realistic focused planning. We realized early on we were not in the technology business. We were in the trust business. The primary job we had was to ensure the participants that the data would be used for the advancements of patient care, but more important, that it would not be used against their own self-interest and that they could trust one another to do this. We found that all concerns about we're going to lose patients or the world's going to come to an end or somebody's going to report it have been false, and you can talk to the people in Memphis about that. Governor Bredesen, who has a technology background, has urged in national meetings, build version 1.0 first. We believe, I personally believe, that any organization that's facing a quick timeline, and that would include the timeline we had for the ARC contracts, and I would submit also includes meaningful use, anyone that tries to do too many things in a short period of time is doomed to fail. Almost every health information exchange that tried to be comprehensive certainly took longer to get going than one that stayed focused on one or two things. That's not to say that in the long term that's not a good strategy. I just don't think you're going to get quick wins if you do that. As I said, we focused only on emergency department care. The data came from throughout the community, every hospitalization, every visit, but the only place this was used initially was the emergency department. Later on, hospitalists used it and a safety net clinic used it because they kept calling up the emergency room or coming down to see the records and see what was going on. We took data in any format, so the total cost to the participants was only the cost of their time, a secure socket layer, and some personnel time, of course, to ensure quality assurance of the data. The overall operational cost is really about $1.5 million a year for this primarily hospital-based system. It would be much larger if we had a lot more small practices hooked up. But when you think about it, for 1 million people, that's $1.50 per member per year. $1.50 compared to an average healthcare spend for an individual of $7,000 or $8,000. So we think it's pretty good. We got some quick wins in the first couple of weeks. We had people write in and say, we think we saved a life today. We found the test. We were maybe lucky on that. But we let it evolve over time. Again, we did not try to shoot for nirvana. We just took it as it started and let people build on it. Example, transcriptions. Everybody sent transcriptions to one major hospital, but over time, the medical community put such pressure on that hospital to participate that they accelerated their intended desire to do that and pushed it up on the queue, if you will, to get them out sooner. They'd always intended to do it, but as you know, when you're dealing with healthcare providers of any type right now, they're in the middle of some very burning technology questions, and you can't necessarily expect them to put health information exchange first. So what have we done? Well, we can give you anecdotes about saving lives. We have a couple papers coming out from a very wonderful PhD student, Kim and Ertl, about workflow and how people view that. We can prove some test ordering behavior changes. We're going to be able, through a large case match control, demonstrate some substantive savings in radiographic tests, particularly CT and head MRI, some reduced testing for specific conditions, which was done by Jim Bailey and colleagues at the University of Tennessee. We're going to be able to show some reduced admissions, comparing HIE users to non-HIE users. And again, that's all being packaged for publication right now, so we're not putting the data out widely at this juncture. We're still really having it go through the peer review process. This model is being adopted by other regions through this for-profit company called Informatics Corporation of America, ICA. We found ambulatory connectivity to be a very tough challenge, and of course that is the challenge today, and the big question is whether or not all of the ONC and high-tech provisions are going to make it easier. And we also found that a lot of the lessons we learned about vaults and technology were also very valuable to us at Vanderbilt inside our own firewalls. What did we learn? Well, you know, you're in the trust business. You need sustained leadership. The low barrier to entry, we think, was very important. Another thing, from the outset, we did not try to go out and get medication history data. We figured with RxHub and SureScript it was going to happen on its own. We feel the same way about independent access to clinical labs. We got all the clinical labs, but we got them through the back end from the hospitals and providers who had them already in their systems. We think architecture is very important because a big challenge to ROI is, can you keep the investment, small enough to get a short-term return? And again, heretical notion, but consumer engagement directly was not critical to us. We had 50 or 60 people who were on the ground floor running emergency departments, involved in patient care, toiling for 9 months to implement the Marco Connecting for Health data sharing agreements back in 2005. And they definitely were the proxies for our consumers. And because we had this deadline that we had to get this thing live, we stayed very focused, very, very practical. Vicki Estrin and others have spoken extensively on this from our group. We did not over-engineer. As I told you, we just tagged data. We didn't map everything to HL7 or SNOMED or anything else. And Janet King and others from our team could talk a lot more about that at some future date. We allowed standards to evolve. We built a simple system, and we just really focused on what we could uniquely do. Again, we did not try to stick in the middle of people doing e-prescribing or laboratory and other things. And we found cost to be paramount to our notion of sustainability. Now, what do I think the predictions are? Well, we were really, again, all about the individual. And we think we will be able to demonstrate very soon in publications that there are real savings just within emergency departments alone by having data available when people make decisions. We believe those ideas will absolutely be sustainable. So when I think of a sustainability strategy, I do not necessarily think of how sustainable will be the models of organizations we built 6 years ago for six leading-edge companies or leading-edge kind of projects to all be financially sustainable in an uncertain world. It's a pretty high barrier. But I think in every case when you're going to hear about these pioneers, you'll see that the intent of what they try to do will indeed be sustainable with some fits and starts. We think what we learned, of course, is that most people thought all the care was coming from in their institution. Really, most of it was coming from elsewhere. We think we can track populations. We can track real time. We can tell you what Memphis's white count is today against yesterday. And we think that's going to change the way people think of the words. Exchange to me is as much a verb, it's a set of service, as it is a noun. We do believe that we will have a number of exchanges in our communities, hospital-based, clinical-based exchanges, which in some places will be the dominant form. In other places may be relatively limited. Each will have a certain scope of activity, for example, readmissions or quality reporting. But don't forget, in a way, a large ASP EHR provider or many, many other people are really de facto exchanges as well. So I personally can't accept 100% the notion of a purely hierarchical model that I practice in the community. I send my information to a local exchange. They go up to the state, and the state goes out to the country. There are some advantages to that. It will be done in some instances, but it won't cover 100% of what we need to do to achieve meaningful use and better patient care. And I think the NHIN framework, as they're working now, is going to be a very exciting way of tying a lot of these things together. And again, value sustainability, it's going to be so hard to measure that. And I would, again, argue to emphasize, will the ideals, will the means to an end, i.e. specific, or the end, be improved patient care, be achieved somehow, and focus more on that than on there's a particular organizational form. And again, advice to organizations, keep it as cheap as small as possible and as simple as small as possible. I wanted to leave you with a neat article by Paul Starr from 1997 that's a very thoughtful piece about technology and policy that still explains some of the culture dynamic today. And I do that because it emphasized the failed chin in Memphis, Tennessee. And again, we knew that, and we realized that what Paul Starr said was very helpful to figure out what the real problems were going to be there. And then I leave you also, that'll be on the slide deck, some sense of a timeline, when things were announced, when we went live, how that interacted with NHIN and HISPIC and the ONC things. So even though we were up in a different world, if you will, more in the ARC world, we were tracking and building on all the national lessons we could have. So with that, that concludes my part of this webinar, and I will go on mute, and we'll have questions later.
Thank you, and just to remind everybody, so you don't forget your questions, feel free to submit your questions along the way, and we will actually address them after all three presenters have presented. So, Patricia, if you'd like to take the helm, we look forward to hearing from you.
Well, thank you very much. It is a great pleasure to be a part of this presenting team today. I'm going to come less from the big picture structural standpoint and talk to you about some of the foot soldiers on the ground with what has been called the litmus test for health information exchange success, and that is, will the smaller practices participate? A little bit of the punchline is given away in the title slide here. One of the folks that we talked to kind of summed it up as they say, you know, they're interested, but somebody needs to say, do it. And they're looking to the people like the Marks and the Ginas to help them do this. So let me give you a little bit of background that you're all familiar with, but it gives a slightly different perspective from our work compared to Marks and Ginas. We are also funded by the AHRQ task order to do this study, which actually just appeared in the Archives of Internal Medicine in April. So the background is that the ERA Act is going to provide billions, as you all know. And it's not, and while we're thinking about health information exchange, a lot of the family physicians that we interviewed are still looking at that first item, which is getting electronic health records. So we've got all of those steps before we can achieve the goal of a National Health Information Network, or the NHIN. In our state, Minnesota has really been setting the stage for health information exchange with some legislative mandates. Our 2007 e-health law did require electronic claim submission by 2009, e-prescribing by 2011, and we have on the books that we're all going to have interoperable EHRs, all hospitals and providers, by 2015. Now, we have a good head start compared to some other states that are out there. According to Stratus Health, which does a survey, 42% of Minnesota primary care practices have fully implemented EHRs, compared to only 4% nationally. Now, there is a lot going on in Minnesota as far as high tech and the structural aspects. And I'm not specifically going to address that, but I wanted, in case any of you are out there listening, I wanted you to know that we are certainly aware of that. The definition that the Office of the National Coordinator has for HIV as the electronic movement of health-related information among organizations according to nationally recognized standards is a very strict definition. You know, as Mark has already pointed out, it has to do with languages, HL7, SNOMED, it has to do with LOINC coding and so forth. And as we did our project, which involved actually going out and talking to the physicians and administrators in small primary care practices to see what the barriers were for them or what benefits they hoped to achieve by getting involved in health information exchange, we found that many of them didn't really understand the concept or the definition of HIE. You know, technically what HIE is not, you know, we had to kind of discuss with them. It's not the information that is exchanged within self-contained networks. You know, so we have a large number of clinics that are all part of the health partner system, for instance. They all use a certain proprietary electronic medical record. That's technically not, you know, health information exchange because it's all within one record. And, you know, so the key concepts here are that it needs to be independent organizations, like Mark talked about, different hospitals or different practices and different health networks, and it has to be interoperable systems done according to national standards. So a couple explanations that we do have in Minnesota. One I'm sure some that you are familiar with is the CHIC, or Community Health Information Collaborative. It's been funded since 1997 and is in northeastern Minnesota. One of its best-known projects is the Patient Record Locator Service. Also, a little newer on the scene is Minnesota Health Information Exchange, or MinHI, and it has a project also focused in the emergency department. And it had to do with medication lookup. So MinHI's structure concept, layperson's concept, is given here in the diagram. So our study, the rationale is then that most existing studies of HIE have taken place in the hospitals and in the larger health systems, whereas the majority of healthcare encounters occur in the ambulatory setting, and that's where the majority of patients really receive their care. So if we really want to make an impact on healthcare outcomes, we need our efficiencies and our quality improvements to address the ambulatory care setting, not to mention the fact that for the NHIN to become a reality, our practices have to become involved. So the specific aims, as I alluded to, are to assess the motivating factors and barriers that are going to influence primary care practices to participate in community-wide health information exchange. Our study had a soft side to it. It was largely a qualitative study. We did collect quantitative data through a questionnaire on practice demographics and the existing IT status. But basically, we did analysis of guided discussions with key informants, and these were in 9 practices throughout the state. The key informants varied quite a bit. Some of the clinics that were part of some larger systems had somebody who was specifically designated to help them with health IT. Others were small, solo practices that were basically creating their systems through the ingenuity and the persistence of their docs and their support staff. So we'll find out a little bit more. Our study was conducted fairly recently, as you see, 2008-2009. The 9 practices were all primarily family medicine, and we purposely selected them to include 4 urban practices, 5 rural locations, and all of the practices had fewer than 20 providers. They had varying degrees of involvement with electronic records and with health information exchange, but we did pick them because they had at least some potential connection with health information exchange efforts in their part of the state. For example, you'll see on the map here that in northeastern Minnesota, the practices that we were fortunate to be able to make our visits to in January, these were very knowledgeable about the CHIC collaborative. In the metropolitan area, the three practices there were urban safety net clinics that had achieved some achieved some funding to just get started with a health information exchange within their network. And then finally in southwestern Minnesota, there had been an attempt to achieve a health information exchange having to do with congestive heart failure patients. So I'm going to run us through some of the results from these nine practices. I think we found just in the basic who's using EHRs, what kind of EHRs are you using, what kind of EHRs are your hospitals using, I think we got at one of the big barriers to health information exchange. In our nine practices, there were seven that were currently using a proprietary electronic health record, one that was in the process of purchasing, and one that actually had developed a little bit earlier on its own relational database and was using a custom product. Of the seven who were using proprietary EHRs, six different vendors were represented. This was just a random sample or a purposely selected sample, but had no idea we were going to find that much variation in vendors. And only one practice had the same electronic health record system as its local hospital. We had a community health service that whose patients actually went from one county hospital to another private hospital. It had really a great need for being able to exchange information, but they chose an electronic health record, for example, that was advertised to them as having the kinds of reporting capability that FQHCs need. And so they bought that so that they could do their quality reporting to the federal agencies and had no capability then of connecting to the local hospitals. As far as the types of information being exchanged, and this could be either sending, receiving, or both, and some of this was web-based and it wasn't necessarily interoperational. As I said, not all of the people that we talked to really great understood the concept, but what they filled out on the survey was all nine were using the immunization registry, which again has been championed by CHIC. Eight laboratory test results, again talking about your quick wins, that's a big payoff. Four radiology test results. Communicating with payers and pharmacy were also at that level. Patients, one of our practices had a patient portal, and as far as other physician practices, none were able to exchange electronically with their consultants at this point. So we talk about motivating factors. We've divided them in our analysis quantitatively of the key informant interviews. We divided them into external motivators and internal motivators, and you can see the subcategories there. Obvious external motivators that would jump to your minds are the legislative mandates, the payer incentives that we have, and an increased expectation for quality reporting, which is becoming really quite structured and more sophisticated each year in our state of Minnesota. The internal motivators, you know, I'm really pleased to report that I think whether we were talking to doctors or whether we were talking to administrators, and maybe it was more on the clinical than the administrative side, but improved quality of care came out as one of the first reasons that people were going, looking toward developing their electronic records and their health information exchange. Enhanced efficiency and cost savings were closely aligned in second place there. And interestingly, talking on the ground, this is something that doesn't come up a lot in other published studies, and it's hard to survey, but a lot of anecdotes about what it means for the public perception, for the patient's perception, when you can be in the room and have a computer and get that lab result from when they saw the consultant and you've got it at your fingertips, or when you can bring up some patient information, self-management information, and get it to them at the point of care. They recognize that they are being perceived as up to date. And as far as the generation gap in motivation, while we heard lots of stories about older physicians saying, you know, I'm going to retire before I'm ever going to do this stuff, we heard savvy administrators and younger physicians say, the residents and students are using this. We need to get it into our practices to be able to recruit them. And this is even in outstate Minnesota and rural areas. So I mentioned the requirement for interoperable EHRs by 2015. This was referred to as, quote, and I'm going to have some quotes here in italics, the legislation breathing down your neck, telling you what you need to do. So it wasn't really favorably viewed, but people were aware of it. There is both optional and mandated quality reporting. We have Minnesota Community Measurement with sets of measures that require a tremendous amount of work, overhead, staff time on the parts of smaller practices that don't have a central core of administrative staff to do this kind of work for them. So, you know, a typical quote from a practice like that is, you know, quality measures were defining the issues of reimbursement. So we felt that we needed to have a system that would allow direct reporting and sometimes direct extraction from the record in order to be competitive. Improved quality of care might be phrased this way: difficult to achieve consistency over time with paper guidelines. People have to look things up. And they just feel that having something that's hardwired into the practice might help them achieve higher quality and better patient safety, whether this is practice guidelines, so forth. Efficiency, another motivator. And these, are, like I say, are tales from the front line, but one administrator said to us, prior to our electronic record, 2 out of every 3 visits, the medical record itself wasn't available. It was in transit at the dermatologist's office. They weren't done with it, or, you know, we just don't know where the record is. Another said, you know, for the quality reporting, we do 2,000 hand audits a year, going through paper charts at 20 minutes per chart. You do the math for the amount of hours that they're paying staff to do that. So kind of a transition issue that bridges both efficiency and cost savings through electronic records, especially when the reporting can go directly through health information exchange. Cost savings, many folks out there think that by getting rid of paper charts as the first step toward getting into these exchanges, they can reduce the number of people handling paper and downsize staff, basically. And we're in an era of, have been in an era of downsizing, and many businesses and medicine is no exception. They thought that would help their return on investment. Let's turn now to some of the barriers. Again, cost was probably a huge barrier for all the practices we talked to. Interoperability, equally. A lack of a shared HIE vision, I think, is critically important. I mean, I think Mark has given you a wonderful picture of the advantages there to having a shared vision and making it work. And then we found that especially some of our rural practices had problems with just technology infrastructure, like slow T1 lines for connecting. Security privacy concerns, and I've already kind of alluded to the behavioral resistance to change in the older physicians. When you talk about cost as a barrier, sometimes you would be surprised what the price tag is. In a community clinic, $6,000 was a limiting factor for them, $6,000 a year for being in a health information exchange as a noun, and it was going around to the clinics trying to get people to sign up, and they didn't have the $6,000 a year to stay in it plus the startup fees. The interoperability. Everybody has a different system. You have to be able to make them readable. Even with one very common proprietary record in this neck of the woods, there will be proprietary record for this, for your clinic, and up at Clinic C, they've got the same record, but it is programmed slightly differently so that they cannot talk to one another directly. And clinicians are, frankly, really frustrated with that, and they feel like they're in a kind of a consumer-based society that's, and the profit motive is out there, and somebody has to have the authority to say to these companies and these vendors, get together, do it, make it interoperable. So, you know, to conclude, you know, in our study, there was not one practice that was fully involved in a regional HIE with multiple stakeholders according to a strict definition. Rather, health information exchange as a verb is proceeding by incremental stages, and the EHR acquisition is a first step that hopefully some of the funding will expedite. I'm happy to report that small practices do see the value of the data exchange. Most commonly, and where they really see the quick wins, are with hospitals, testing centers, and to be developed specialists with whom they interact frequently. The public health agencies and the quality reporting agencies are also really quick wins from that standpoint. Our conclusion, and in a way I think Mark also had a little bit of a caveat when he said he's not convinced 100% about the hierarchical models here, we had to conclude that interoperable HIE may not be the best short-term model for data sharing for small practices until we get further development of national interoperability standards and find feasible ways that we can get around programming multiple specific interfaces to patch every institution's record with anyone that differs by even just a little bit. And security and privacy policies we haven't talked a lot about, but those are, again, issues that are being addressed on a national level and will make a big difference. So the legislation that will help will be the current legislation is on a good path for that, and we need more community leaders like Mark and Gina to provide meaningful interactions and really that joint vision that's going to be so critical to get what in the clinical world can be competing partners who are a little bit turfy about their information, to get them all to work together toward the common goals. So thank you very much, and I will turn to Gina.
Thanks, Pat. That was very nice to have sort of your presentation and some of the research you've done bound by the two existing health information exchanges. So Gina will be interested to hear about your model, which has been equally successful but somewhat different from the Memphis model. We'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, and thank you all for participating in the call. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Delaware Health Information Networking, kind of some of the keys to success that we've identified, and focus a little bit also on the sustainability of the health information exchange. Let me get my slides moving here. So what I always like to do is start with where in the heck is Delaware, and we are on the East Coast in between Pennsylvania and Maryland, and we are a small state first to ratify the Constitution and first to implement statewide health information exchange. So we are proud of those two firsts. We are a public-private partnership. We have a board of directors, so the governance, the financing, and the data exchange is all both state and private, as well as we have federal funding, which began with our ARC State and Regional Demonstration Project, and also through the Nationwide Health Information Network, and now the state HIE Cooperative Agreement. We have begun data exchange in 2007 with secure results delivery, and that was of lab, radiology, pathology, and admission discharge transfer data from hospitals and national labs. We now have what we call a community health record, which is essentially what you might have heard as the query or the pull model, and that is the ability of users to query a patient-centric longitudinal health record from the exchange from multiple sources. We are focusing now on, of course, supporting our hospitals and physicians in meeting meaningful use, as well as the requirements of the state HIO cooperative agreements. We began the process of implementation with understanding our environment. So we spent some time talking with consumers, physicians, hospitals, health plans, specialty groups to understand what they wanted from Health Information Exchange. And what we heard from providers is they want electronic results into their electronic health records. They didn't want to be scanning paper, and they wanted point-to-point interfaces. They wanted streamlined information. So they were getting labs and radiology reports from multiple sources in multiple ways, and it was very hard to track them down. And often when they had the patient in front of them, the information that they needed wasn't there. And what we heard from hospitals and labs was they were getting bombarded with requests for interfaces, and they were costly, especially around the hospitals, and they didn't want to manage all those point-to-point interfaces. They wanted a more efficient way to get information from their source systems, from their labs and radiology systems and their admission systems to the providers that ordered those tests. And so essentially the problem looks like this. This is what we call the spaghetti. It's all of those organizations that serve the physician community and the patient community needing to get information out to those locations. So at the bottom, we might have physician practices, but we also have public health agencies. We have home health agencies and long-term care facilities and mental health facilities. All those organizations order tests and have relationships with hospitals and labs and radiology facilities, others. So the idea of DIN is to streamline the process to look more like this, where we've got those data sender organizations sending information to the exchange through one single standardized interface using HL7, and the HIE acting as the mailman or the post office to get the information out to the ordering provider, the copy to the primary care provider, the admitting attending providers, and then making that information available for authorized users to query so that they can see information on a patient who might be new to them or whom they might be seeing in an emergency situation or whom they may have received a referral on. So we deliver those results in three ways. One is through an inbox where the user can log into DIN. They can view their clinical reports and results in an inbox kind of or an email-looking fashion, of course, secure. And then they can query the DIN from that location. That is, all they need there is a Windows-based computer, high-speed internet, and a networked printer if they want to print the results. They can also set that inbox to print, and they can print based on their workflow. And we give them out-of-range results, and they could maybe print with all their out-of-range results on top. They can also sort their inbox to do the same. And then lastly, and probably most importantly, we have direct interfaces with electronic health record systems where that interface allows the EMR vendor to deploy the DIN data coming from the hospitals and labs who participate in DIN, to physician practices in a streamlined, single interface manner. So it's much less expensive. It's much more efficient. The doctors really appreciate that, and it has created almost immediate efficiencies in the practices that have those interfaces. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. The other important factor is that our paper reports are all standardized as well. So it doesn't matter which organization generated the report. It is it looks the same with the exception of the contact information and the logo of the organization. So that's a big satisfier among the physicians because and physician practices because they're able to look immediately in a certain place to identify the information that they're most interested in. And this is the state in terms of who participates. So the red stars are participating hospitals. We also have LabCorp and Quest Diagnostics statewide, and we have Doctors Pathology Services, which is a regional pathology lab for the state of Delaware. We have two other hospitals that we are working with to establish a relationship, and we have another hospital that's in implementation and should be going live this summer. We're also working with small labs and radiology facilities to get them on board as well. So I already really talked about what we're doing from 2007 and 2008. I think the important feature here is what you heard from Mark, I think, and from Pat, some important common themes, and that's around urgency, focus, trust, and starting small and being incremental about your approach. So in terms of urgency, we got the ARC contract, and it gave us a deadline. We had to be live by March 30th, 2007, and we were. And so that was the urgency that if we want to keep this funding and we want to meet our contractual requirements with ARC, we're going to get this done. So we came live with five hospitals and LabCorp. The following year, we built the foundation for the Master Patient Index and Record Locator Service, which allowed us to do query, and we started to build the relationships with the EMR vendors for those direct interfaces. We have negotiated 75% discounted rates on the EMR vendor interface. So in other words, where a physician practice might have had to pay or get someone else to pay for an interface to every hospital and every lab, they get all of that information from one interface to DIN, and we've negotiated a rate for them that's about a 75% discount off of a single interface. We also have public health reporting from hospital emergency departments and labs for biosurveillance reporting. And then going forward, we went live in 2009 with that patient search function and brought the other data centers on board and, again, started participating with the Nationwide Health Information Network. This year we're working on, again, focusing with meeting, helping our providers meet meaningful use. So, you know, our data centers, our hospitals have put an investment into DIN. You know, they help finance the system. And as a result of that, they should be getting benefit in terms of us helping them get to where they need to be to get those incentive dollars from the federal government. So the kinds of things that we're looking at are moving transcribed reports, laboratory order entry from an EMR through DIN and into those source systems so that they don't have to be able to build that capacity on their own, supporting those EMR connections, having a referral network in place so that physician practices and hospitals can move data electronically to support the movement of the patient from a primary care to a specialist to a hospital, maybe to a long-term care facility, depending on the situation. And in terms of how else we help providers meet that meaningful use, it's really about not having to make an added investment in technology, using the infrastructure that's already in place, the investments they've already made to support those activities. From the physician perspective, it's giving them tools to help them incrementally meet meaningful use. Perhaps they're not ready to implement a full functional EMR, but maybe we can give them some modular kinds of services that support them meeting the early meaningful use criteria. And then the kinds of services that look at supporting non-priority providers such as mental health, home health, long-term care, radiology facilities in order to get them to a point where they are interoperable even though they don't or can't participate in the federal incentives. In terms of DIN's success, we have over 60% of the physician practices that are participating with DIN. You can see it's a broad array of specialties which participate, and it's very consistent with the population of providers in the state. This just shows a little bit of a scale of when we went live with the patient search function in June of last year. You know, we had about 685,000 unique patients. You can see the users that participated, and you can see how that has increased very significantly just in 6 months because the value that the users get from being able to query the system. You can also see here in terms of usage. So before, when we were just distributing results, logins were low. A lot of the practices had auto print, so they never needed to log into the system. But once we implemented the query function, logins sort of have gone through the roof because there's a real value to log into the system and to query for patient information. And by the way, we do monitor those queries, so we know when it's appropriate or inappropriate use, and there is processes in place to question and terminate use when we have any concern. This is just a graph of the transaction volume. Just we move about 15 million transactions on average a month. That is so that's information processed through the system, which is pretty significant. And in terms of governance, we do have a multi-stakeholder approach to governance. We talked about the public-private partnership. You heard from Mark about this is a trust project. It absolutely is, and for us it's also a consensus project. That largest hospital has no more authority or no more say in how what functionality gets implemented or how the HA is operated than the very smallest of organizations. So it's very much consensus-based. And we do, again, have representation from all of these stakeholder groups on all of our committees, and I won't get into the kind of what all of these committees do, but you can see that there's a lot of diversity in terms of looking at the kinds of users or benefactors of the HIE and making sure that they're all part of the decision-making process and providing advisory capacity to the decision-makers. In terms of, I think, the keys to success, it's very important for health information exchanges to engage the leadership at the organizations that participate. When you have the IT folks at a hospital participating and committing to it, that's great. But if the CEO and the CFO and the CIO aren't fully engaged in the value that the HIE brings, it's not going to necessarily be a priority, and those folks can get easily pulled off on other projects. So there really has to be an organizational commitment to the health information exchange and then dedicated resources to ensure that project management at each of the contributing organizations is strong, that there are testing resources allocated to make sure that data integrity is absolutely the number one priority. And then there's, for our approach, we have our funding is a third, 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 federal, state, and private. So the financial commitment of the private sector is very, very important. Again, moving forward with sustainability, for us it's really been kind of building that strong foundation, starting incrementally, understanding the needs of those involved in health information exchange, and building the functions that provide value to them. So one, they'll participate. Two, they'll financially support it. And three, they'll remain engaged because as we build the foundation, we build it with an incremental approach and then add the fixtures that add value to the other players so that there's an ongoing dynamic approach to looking at the environment, what's happening at the federal level, what's happening at the community level, what the needs are of the organizations, and being nimble and flexible in addressing those needs. This just shows you a little bit more about the funding, which I really have already talked about. I think the important part here is that for our state dollars, we have leveraged other sources of funding. So for every dollar in state funding, we've leveraged almost $4 in other funding sources, which is pretty significant, and again, shows that there's a very diverse approach to financing. And with that, I will turn it back over to Erin.
Who I think is going to turn it over to Colin.
Yes, thank you. And in a few moments, you will see a survey come up on your screen. Please take a few moments and complete that. We really appreciate getting your feedback. And we're also going to move now into the Q&A. Remember, just click on the Q&A tab there at the top, and you can type your question in. And I'm going to turn it back to Erin.
Great, thank you. And we have just a few questions right now, so I hope as we start moving on with those questions, that will jot some more ideas down. Otherwise, I always have a bunch of questions to ask, which I'll be happy to do. Our first question came in, I think this came in during Pat's presentation, but I think that actually any of the three of you can answer this or and may have a different spin. But the question was, have you considered a focus on transitions of care between nursing home residents and the ER or the hospital? And if not, where is this on the priority list?
I can speak for Delaware. We do have a continuity of care work group, which essentially is transitions of care. And we are looking at how the HIE can support those activities. So the first step was getting the long-term care, home health, and ED folks using the system, and then bringing them and giving them several months to get used to it and to understand it and to think about it in terms of their own workflow. So this summer we're going to be pulling them all back together to talk about, okay, now that you've used the HIE, how do you think it can support those activities better? And there's a lot of nuances, I'm sure you know, in terms of what information needs to move back and forth for Medicare payments various aspects of the care process. So we really need to take all of that into consideration as well.
Pat, I know your study was focused, obviously, on the primary care setting, but are you doing or planning any work looking at transitions in care specifically related to nursing homes, nursing home residents?
You know, we definitely asked all of our, in all of the practices, we asked them what kind of connections they had with their nursing homes. And in some of the smaller towns, as you can imagine, the long-term care facilities may be part of the hospital or right next door to the hospital, and the clinic may be right there on campus as well. So you would think that the transitions, you know, in those three arenas would be, you know, some of the low-hanging fruit to try to accomplish. And yet, they could be geographically right next door and have two different records because the clinic bought one and the hospital, you know, bought another. One of the big problems was who could afford what. And also there is a proprietary product, as I said, that's very common here that won't go out to small practices. So when I hear Gina's talk about how they are actually helping with the programming of the multiple interfaces from one setting to the next and are actually bringing state, federal, and private money together to make that possible, I think, you know, that's exactly what needs to be done to make to make it even possible to study those transitions in care. And certainly I agree with whoever asked that question. You're on to really a hot-button topic because medication reconciliation between the hospital, the ambulatory practice, and the nursing home is a big area that is time-consuming, complicated, and an area for where patient safety is important.
Thanks. Mark, how about the work that I know you guys are in the early stages of this, but I think you've you can definitely consider nursing homes. How's that working in Memphis or in some of the other exchanges you've been involved in?
Well, I'll speak about how we would do it in Memphis. We haven't. We stayed, again, very focused. I need to emphasize that the goal of the last 5 years was to address certain specific problems and not them all. Nursing homes, obviously, were high on the radar screen. In terms of the way it would work in Memphis and the current architecture, we could have data sharing agreements with the nursing homes and have two-factor authentication passive web browsers in the nursing homes very quickly. We could put basically a resident census on there that could serve as an authentication for making sure they only selected records of nursing home residents, we'd have audit logs, all that stuff. Getting information from the hospital, nursing home is pretty easy. In our architecture right now, though, we don't have explicitly the discharge medication list. We would separate the medication reconciliation problem, which is a national problem that kind of stands on its own, both in terms of nursing home medication dispensing systems, specialty distributions, and other resources to link that up. And, you know, when we talk medication reconciliation, we always forget herbals and over-the-counters and non-prescription drugs. We think that's a whole separate kind of issue and may have a different kind of solution. So even though it's very important, sadly, it's a fine example where the financial incentives almost argue towards admission in many places and not watching them there. But it's definitely, again, it's a great question. And I think the good news is a lot of the HITECH Act provisions are going to make it a lot easier for our communities to connect to one another and transmit some of the basic information sooner than later.
Thank you, all of you. Gina, there was a specific sort of technical question for you asking if you could explain a bit more about how the provider accesses the health information exchange, or I guess maybe the data from the health information exchange, and gets that information securely.
Okay. It is web-based. It is secure web-based. So each user has a unique login and password, and there's some protocols around password protections and changes and all of that good stuff. So they log into the exchange. They access their inbox, and from the inbox they can query. Now, if they query a patient that is their patient, that they're going to see their data. So I liken it to the paper chart. If you think about a person working in a doctor's office opens up the paper chart and can see what's in the chart. So that first level of query is for what is that practice's information. The next level of query requires a break glass component. So if the user wants to see what other provider information is available in the exchange, they would establish a relationship with the patient beyond the information that they've received on the patient. They have to give a reason why they're looking, and they have to give a parameter for the time frame that they're looking for. That gets audited, monitored, reported on a regular basis. So that's primarily how the portal's used. For providers who have an EMR that is connected with DIN, the data goes directly from the exchange in real time to the EMR and is deployed into the patient chart. It sends an alert to the provider to let them know that they have new information on their patient.
Thanks, Gina. Now we'll jump from the very specific to the very broad. And I think, you know, any of the three of you can address this. How do you think the current ONC initiatives might have changed your work, or is there something that you might have done differently? I think, assuming that the ONC initiatives, you had been starting your work when after the ONC initiatives were up and running.
This is Mark. I can start with that maybe. First, I just have to give ONC credit for doing an incredible job, in my view, managing HITECH, because, again, a lot of this is congressional actions that are setting rather ambitious goals. And what I have seen come from ONC in response to the HITECH legislation are a bunch of issues that are going to make it simpler, particularly for the nursing home problem, the small medical practitioner, and a number of other things to make it easier and lower that interface cost and all those other things until it's just something expected. It's like in the old days with a PC, you bought a personal computer and then you paid extra for an Ethernet card. It's now inconceivable that an Ethernet card wouldn't be bundled at a very low cost into a PC. We're going to see that same issue evolve with interoperability. Second, there's been a lot of work over the last 4 or 5 years for standards. Those are coming to fruition. In particular, there's been some movement in terms of what Dr. Blumenthal and others have called data liquidity to make sure that pharmacy data and laboratory data and other things are going well. I think the allergies are still a problem, but there's starting to be more work on that, which is comforting. I think the antenna architecture are nice pieces. So I think that's all the good news. for people, again, who I think when you compare that with Section 3013 and the state grants, there's some real there's a tendency for some to think that this is an either-or situation, that somehow all these lightweight connectivity things jeopardize a specific organization like a Memphis or a Delaware. I actually think they make their job easier and allow them to focus on where the real value is to their community. So I just think that, as I say, if the ice cream truck's coming your way, you don't have to run to the ice cream truck. And a lot of the good things that we always wanted to do are going to be made a lot easier because of ONC.
Thanks. Pat or Gina, anything you want to add to that?
I would just say that we had a very long defined roadmap, and everything that ONC has in the state and regional demonstration project requirements was on our roadmap, so that was very encouraging. The timing of it, however, is what we changed. So we moved some things up that we had further out and put some things off as a result of that. So, and by the way, we were pretty clear in responding to that, that our stakeholders needed to be bought into that. So they were part of the decision-making process of, yeah, we're willing to put this off and move this up because it's part of a greater good.
Great. Moving back into some of the specifics of Health Information Exchange, we have a question here. Has anyone addressed the issue of preventing data errors and the example that was given here, incorrect test results, and how do you correct the errors? Or I guess maybe a different way to say it is data integrity. Maybe what kind of systems do you have in place to ensure the highest data integrity, that you're not attaching the test results to the wrong patient, as an example?
This is Mark. I can answer. First, in terms of the matching algorithms, we did a lot of work generating kind of the equivalent of a receiver operating curve and set this thing down so that we would miss some true matches, but at the expense of not having as many, not as much risk of a false match. Secondarily, for our browser, you can always see the complete demographic file for any date item. So every institution, if you're saying, that looks like the wrong person, you can go down and see what was their name and address and check that out. That's never really been used. There's never been a problem with it because of the way we've set it. We spend a lot of time on QA for the parsers, obviously. And the final thing is everything in our system has that property called non-repudiation. You can roll back the system through the audit log and see what the results were then. And if there's a change to it, it's updated, and it's a temporal result. It's an update in real time like any other EHR.
Hi, this is Pat. I can just give a little bit from the qualitative side, again from the physician standpoint. We hear a lot about patient safety and how it can be improved by medical records, and I do believe it can. Some of the anecdotes that we heard were that, you know, for every problem they take care of for you, for instance, your drug doses, now you, with a click of a button, you can choose the medication and have it sent electronically to the pharmacy, There's another type of error that can creep in, which is, you know, the cursor slips, so you accidentally send the next med on the alphabetized list in for the patient instead of the one that you needed. For the built-in flags that are there to guide clinical practice and make it safer, you know, please don't prescribe this drug because it will interact with something that's already on the medication list. That's only as good as having the medication list updated. And in addition, when there are systems where the flags are coming fast and furious and you've got a busy practitioner, we heard stories of many of them just kind of turning off the flags or ignoring them because they just didn't really give them critical information that was going to impact their practices.
And Gina, anything you wanted to add about preventing data errors?
Well, we have kind of multiple layers. I think the first and foremost is going back to the model of, is it post office, is that the source system and sends us the result. Now, suppose they go back and identify that there's been an issue with it. When they send an update, it updates the DIN system as well. So, and again, there's all the auditing that goes along with that. There is a mechanism for information to be moved from one patient to another or changed in the HIE by the source organization. So suppose one of the hospital sends information, it attaches to the wrong patient, there's an application that they can go in and move it from one patient to the other. So that those mechanisms are in place. Thirdly, we have what we call the HIMSS committee, and their job is to manage, review, evaluate data integrity. That goes from the master patient index down to very specific clinical data, and there are all kinds of processes involved with auditing the system for that and then addressing, you know, there's a date of birth off from this organization to this organization. Let's figure out which is the right date of birth, and then that source system go and correct it. So there's lots of activities and mechanisms that are used to address that. But it's number one priority for us.
Thanks.
And Erin, this is Pat. If I could just add on top of that, I think it's going to be very interesting as we actually study these systems and watch the health outcomes and see if we can reduce medical errors. Because, and I'll be really interested to see some of the data that Mark is going to be coming out with. I think that the overall benefit will outweigh the kinds of anecdotal stories that I'm relating, and I just don't want to leave that hanging out there. But I think it's going to take those studies and getting that data out there, and it'll be really interesting to watch it as it comes out in the next couple of years.
Great. Thanks for that comment, Pat.
Pat, also, just so you know, we in 5 years and a lot of use, we still won't be able to demonstrate any impact on medical errors. The numbers are simply too small and the analysis too hard, but we can just address the cost. I wish that were the case, but I think it's I think that's further down the road, and it's going to be more drilling down from an institution using an exchange rather than an exchange per se. My 2 cents.
Thank you.
All right, another sort of operational question that seems to be at the top of everybody's minds. Is there a patient opt-in or opt-out process? How do you handle patient consent?
Our consent model is opt-out. The patient has the option to be basically all in or all out, and if they opt out, then their information is not available for query even by their provider.
Thanks. Mark?
This was a 9-month process working with about 50 or 60 people in the grassroots. Again, Vicki Estrin, Janet King, a lot of people were there, but it was really the leadership in Memphis that did it. It's an opt-out model. The opt-out rate is just slightly over 1%. It's a little bit different in urban and suburban hospitals. There are specific policies that are across the exchange, but the actual notification and how that's done changes from institution to institution. You will find if you're dealing particularly with national healthcare organizations that there are certain limitations about how you can and cannot do that. So everybody has to be notified. Everybody has to have certain abilities to do things, and then, but how it's actually done is at an institutional level. Also, when you opt out for the institution. You don't opt out globally across the exchange the way we built it, good or bad. And the other thing that worries me a great deal is that people somehow think if they opt out of the exchange, their information is not shared anywhere, and of course, through health plans and everything else, it's part of their fiduciary responsibility. I always worry that people that opt out have the false sense of illusion when actually their data is all over the place. Who knows where it goes?
I agree, and that's actually part of the education process that we go through when a patient would attempt to opt out. There's several steps they have to take, and part of it is education of what does it mean to opt out.
Good. Those are all good points, and just from my perspective, there aren't too many health information exchanges out there that I know of that are doing opt-in. Rhode Island has chosen that method and can provide you with a lot of
learnings in terms of what that means from a technology perspective, but also their rationale for why they did it that way, which included having a lot of community involvement in making that decision. The next question, I'll read it and then I'll try to maybe translate it, is that it appears that historically the interoperability issues have been paramount to health information exchange and the interest slash participation by providers to get involved. Other than somebody do it, how is this issue going to be solved? And so I think maybe the person who asked this question is getting at the fact, you know, and Pat, you talked about this in the communities that you looked at where, you know, everybody had a different electronic health record, and so then you have to, you know, do you have to develop a separate interface for every single one of those to even participate in the health information exchange? And then if the providers bear that cost, you know, that was certainly a barrier to being involved. So I don't know if any of the three of you have thoughts on how what you know about how this issue is being solved currently or ideas on what might be the best way to go about solving that issue. Or is it solvable?
I'm having trouble still getting my head around the exact issue.
I am too.
Can you take another stab at the question?
Yeah, I'll try that. And Randall, if you're still at your computer and want to type in some clarifying remarks, I guess that interoperability is still a key part of health information exchange and interoperability writ large. We don't have a nice, easy solution because even electronic health records that are out there and claim to be interoperable, you still have to build interfaces. And, you know, maybe that's just a part of health information exchange, or is there an easy way to begin to, or is there work going on that's going to make interoperability a much smoother and a real process, I guess?
Okay, a couple principles. First, make it incremental. Don't try to be all operational, interoperable to everything. Look, for example, at the Reagan Streif Institute, which has got one of the best exchanges around. A lot of it's delivered by fax. I mean, you know, interoperability as a technical goal should be secondary to getting information where you need it. Also understand that some of these things are going to come in automatically, like I said, like SureScripts or medication history services and e-prescribing. And so I think the people who are going around and charging everybody $25,000 to do the same interface over and over again for every customer, that's going to be a dinosaur strategy over time. I just think that one should just be patient and not panic and try to make all things interoperable with everything else. I think to go out right now and try to build all kinds of interfaces to automatically incorporate all of your data into your system 100% of the time because the clinicians rightfully don't want to look at two interfaces. Well, you know, you can do that, or you can just say that usually clinicians don't need all that information and some of it's there, and kind of wait and kind of find a secondary approach. For example, you can incorporate information, match it to the right patient, and just take all the PDF and keep it like an external correspondence, like a PDF document. There's some intermediate strategies you can employ. But I think that this is a fine example of trying to get lost in the weeds of a version 6.0 before you got the basics right. And I would just urge patience with this.
I totally agree. And you know, our approach has been meet them where they are. So, you know, if they are a totally paper-based practice, put them on auto print. They're, you know, they don't ever have to log into their computer. It's going to print, and they're going to get everything they need, and it's going to be streamlined, and they're going to be happy. And then work with them to move to the next phase and the next phase. But you got to keep it simple, and you got to meet them where they are.
And I just am going to echo what both of you had said. I think the quote was from a clinician who was like the IT champion at his group. And he was just very frustrated with the proprietary products and the kind of attitude that Mark alluded to, which is that they will make product A different from product B just by a little bit, because they do that way they sell their product. sell a new product, and it works for the vendor, but it doesn't really work for anybody else. And so that's why I say that full interoperability isn't really the best model for small practices now. That frustrated person, I think they just wanted a federal authority to take the vendors, you know, and regulate them or something. And yet, you know, that may not be the model that works the best, you know, in this country. So another model that works well is what CHIC has done with the immunization registry, and it has to do with those alternative ways of getting information to people that Mark and Gina have mentioned. You know, it just started out as a web-based where each practice could log in and put immunization information into it and get information back out, you know, from just through the web. And now it has gone incrementally with the incremental improvements to developing interoperable interfaces so that they can talk directly to one another. You know, for the average practitioner, does it really register to them that they're using web-based interface versus a different interoperable direct interface? Probably not.
Thank you. I think we have time for one more question, I'll take actually a stab at this question, and the rest of you who may or may not know about this initiative can correct me or jump in. But the question was, does anybody know about the initiative in Western Colorado and the HIE called QHN, and is this the same effort that each of the presenters is involved with in their state? Quality Health Network, you're correct, is in Western Colorado. And the focus of that, as I understand it, the focus of that health information exchange is on the Western Slope in Colorado, and is an example of what is going on in many states have multiple health information exchanges that have popped up at the community or several community levels, and that actually is an independent organization that started a number of years ago. And was not part of the state and regional demonstration contracts that were provided by ARC. So in terms of, from a very literal sense, is that the same effort that each of the presenters has been involved in their state? It's similar in that it's a health information exchange, but it was not part of the state and regional demonstration project through ARC. I don't know if Mark or Gina, either of you know any more that you think would be important to talk about QHN.
I really wouldn't want to speak for them.
Yeah.
I just think the idea of pulling people in is something I think needs to be done very early.
Yeah. Okay, well, my computer says 4:30 on the nose, and so I'd like to thank everybody for your participation today. Hopefully you had an opportunity to fill out the survey that should have been on your screen. The feedback that we get from that is very important. I would like to thank all of our panel members, Dr. Frissy, Dr. Fontaine, and Ms. Perez, and that you've got their names and information on the last slide on the screen. And I would encourage you to look out for future events, including our next event, which is a webinar examining health information technology and quality. I don't think the date has been set yet for that, but ARC will be sending out some information on how to register for that in the near future. So, Colin, I'm not sure, or Will, if there's anything else that we need to say before we sign off.
I don't believe so. Again, here's that slide on what's coming up next, and just we want to thank everybody for attending this AHRQ event. We also thank you for your feedback, and we want to thank all of our presenters and our moderator, Aaron, for being here today. This does conclude today's event. You can close down the window. Thanks, and have a nice day.